Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science, with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill discuss how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. The veteran biotech executive also shares his thoughts on how to keep things innovative at a company that's been around since the 1860s. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can find this episode and many more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
At Popular Science, we report and write dozens of science and tech stories every week. And while most of the stuff we stumble across makes it into our articles, we also find plenty of weird facts that we just keep around the office. So we figured, why not share those with you? Welcome to The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week from the editors of Popular Science. I'm Rachel Feltman.
I'm Sarah Trodosh.
I'm Josh Gondelman.
Josh, welcome to the show. Listeners, I'm sure people who enjoy podcasts have heard Josh's voice before. He is a frequent guest on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He hosts a delightful show called Make My Day, which I caught up on a few episodes this morning, and they did truly make my day. So thank you.
Oh my gosh, thank you. That is like truly the kindest compliment, because it's like literally the premise of the show is in the name. I like really just wanted to be like a fun, breezy half hour that makes people feel better on the way out than they came in feeling.
And then you also, after writing for some time for John Oliver, you now write and produce for Jesus and Mero, which I often forget because I kind of just think of your job as being like a national resource to like help us all feel better. So
that's so sweet. Yeah, no, I've been at Jesus and Mero. This is the third season that of the Showtime show, and I've been with them since they started at Showtime, since we started. So it's been, it's been really wonderful. And I've just like had really great fortune to go from like dream job to dream job over the past like 8-ish years.
Amazing. So we wanted to have you on Weirdest Thing because I was like, here's a person who is great at talking about interesting facts in a fun way. And we often get accidentally depressing here on Weirdest Thing. I'm looking at Sarah.
It's mostly me. My beat on this podcast is just like the saddest thing I learned this week. Also with a little weirdness.
It's like, hey, guess who got polio? Like,
yeah. Yeah. This is also, I would say, by far the most Jewish episode of Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week we've ever had.
That's what I was going to say as well. Anticipating this, I was like, oh, we should have aired this like during the week of Passover just so we could fully be maximally Jewish.
Oh, yeah. Just charging up.
So on The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week, we start by each offering up a little tease about some kind of fact or story we found in the course of reading, writing, reporting, making people's days, etc., and decide which one we just absolutely have to hear more about first. Then once we've all had time to spin our little science yarns, we reconvene and decide what the weirdest thing we learned this week actually was. Sarah, would you like to start with your tease?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about how chickens sometimes accidentally miss their oviduct and lay a little bit of an egg inside their body cavity. And other assorted weird egg facts. Weird chicken facts is my beat today.
This is not your first weird egg fact rodeo either.
No, it's not. I actually referred back to the other one because I was like, I don't want to repeat a weird egg fact.
It really says a lot about you as a reporter that you're able to get two full episodes of Weirdest Thing content out of chicken eggs specifically.
Yeah, if anyone needs a chicken egg reporter, I'm your gal.
Listeners just listening like, more chicken egg facts? All right, Sarah, we get it.
So sorry, listeners.
No, I'm intrigued.
Josh, how about your tease?
Mine is about, my fact is about an art heist that still has not been recovered from.
Ooh, I love it.
I love a good heist. My tease is that I would like to talk about a dog that was genetically engineered to serve as a kitchen appliance.
All right. Wow. Well, we have to go with that one first, I feel.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I accept. Okay. And I will say, too, that I had it in my head, Josh, that this would be a great one to have while you were on because I have really enjoyed your comedic references to your dog.
Oh, yeah. My dog, though, she's a chubby little pug. She's so cute and so grumpy. She couldn't serve as any appliance other than maybe like a paperweight. And even then, she's very defiant. She just doesn't have a lot of... she's not very tenacious. She's not especially strong. She eats wet food, and I have to cut the wet food up into pieces because she prefers chunks to gum, and she won't attack it all as one glob anymore. So she's mostly gums. So, yeah, she could maybe be like a business card holder or a paperweight. But other than that, she's not super utilitarian as a pet.
Well, this story ended up kind of being a little darker than I expected, but I'm gonna do my best with it. But it is about a very utilitarian dog. And the long story short here is that people bred these small dogs to have like relatively kind of long bodies and like short, crooked legs, and they were very strong and very high energy. Charles Darwin actually referenced these pups as an example of genetic engineering where humans, you know, specifically bred qualities that would serve them into animals that they were raising. And the reason people did this is so that the dogs could basically power kitchen appliances, which just sounds so wild, but I'm going to explain. So back when open fires were our best way of cooking things, the spit was invaluable. As early as the first century BC, people were sticking meat onto spits so that they could turn it and cook it, because otherwise you would get like half of your mammoth was on fire while the other half stayed raw. Similar issues. But for hundreds of years, that meant that somebody had to be physically turning the spit. And in medieval kitchens, this was a job for like the lowest of the lowly servant boys, and they would be called the spit boy, which is just... God. Or...
Which is now, that's now a different thing. Don't Google it.
Exactly.
I mean, or Google it. Like, if I don't know what
you're into, but you know, Google with caution.
Google with caution. That I think is always good advice.
Yeah. Or they'd be called like Spit Jack, which I think implies that they just called all the boys Jack if they worked on the spit. Which is
Joe Biden was their supervisor. So like,
and that is kind of my impression of like what medieval Europe was like. That you could just be renamed Jack because you were basically a human rotisserie turner. So anyway, the first mention of the turnspit dog, which was also called the Vernerpater cur or Canis vertigus, as in like a dizzy dog, was in 1576. And it was referred to as the turnspit. But most of what we know about them was written down in the 1800s, which was near the end of what was apparently centuries of regular use. So these were dogs. It was a breed of dog, specifically, that had been bred to fit easily into these treadmills that basically looked like the wheels you'd see outside of a mill. But instead of water running through them, there were, like, cranky dogs running through them. And this was a real thing.
That's so cute. The cutest little... Oh, my God. I can't get over it.
It's really cute, but then if you think about... The more you think about it, the less cute it is, which we'll talk about a little more in a second. But there were actually several devices that these dogs could power. Like, they could help mill grain. Really anything that you could attach some kind of, like, treadmill-style gear to, they could power. And there was even a patent for a dog-powered sewing machine in the 19th century. Unclear whether anyone actually used that.
That is the cutest sweatshop condition I've ever heard of. Right?
It's like really, really awful implications, but also so cute.
Yeah, very, very cute and very tragic.
Unfortunately, as some listeners may have already guessed, this job totally sucked for the dogs, for all the reasons that it had sucked for humans. And this was really common, so that we know, like, during the period from that first mention we have in the 1500s until the early 1800s, that it was kind of like the mark of a high-end kitchen was to have at least one turnspit dog. Because if you didn't, that meant that you had a little boy cranking the turnspit, which, you know, maybe it was a little more obvious that that job sucked when it was a tiny human boy. But yeah, according to at least one historian, it was an encounter with a New York hotel's turnspit dogs in the 1850s that inspired Henry Berg to found the ASPCA. So, like, turnspit dogs apparently were our first instance of realizing that maybe animal cruelty was a thing and not just, like, what animals were for.
And, yeah, this feels, I mean, like, obviously there are so many animals that we make do jobs for us that are, like, that seem like maybe not what the animals would prefer to be doing.
Totally.
Like, even a really fast horse, right? You know, they don't necessarily want to take Paul Revere around Revolutionary War Boston. But, like, when you're putting an animal, like, a foot away from another animal that you're cooking, and you're just like, so we're not going to cook you, we hope. But, like, hey, that's on you, dog.
If time get rough, you know, we may have to.
Well, and, like, they worked really long hours. There's just, in kind of the historical accounts we have that mention turnspit dogs, they're always referred to as being very suspicious looking and very, like, really easily trained. In fact, there's some stories about them, like, If you were rich enough to have, like, a pair of turnspit dogs so they could trade off during the day.
Ooh,
like,
okay.
If you accidentally kept one in for too long, it might, like, hop out and be like, my shift is over. Clock it out. Going back home to the missus.
Good
for
the dogs.
Unionize the spit dogs.
Yeah. But it does seem like they were probably treated quite awfully, and it was a really grueling job. And they were even bred to be not just energetic, but, like, it sounds like they kind of bred, like, hyperactivity into the dogs so that they would actually, like, want to run for a long time. Obviously, they were still made to run for longer than they would have liked. And there are awful stories about, like, people doing things like throwing pieces of hot coal in there to, like, try to get them to go faster. But it does seem like they were really bred to be dogs that would mostly be fairly content to just run on a wheel all day. And so, yeah, there were actually as early as 1551, people had like schematics for steam powered roasting jacks, presumably named after the boy named Jack who turned every spit in every medieval kitchen. That was in 1551 by Taqi al-Din in the Ottoman Empire, where generally they were just doing things more sophisticated than making dogs turn their meat. But there was a version patented by an American clockmaker in 1792. And there were also smoke-powered jacks described as early as the 1600s. But a lot of these things were either really expensive or they required kind of like retrofitting your giant old medieval oven that so many of these, like, wealthy houses still had. So I think, you know, one of the reasons that there was that opportunity for the guy who founded the ASPCA to be shocked is that they actually were, like, much less common in the Americas, where the buildings were newer. So people were more likely to be able to, like, build a chimney to accommodate, you know, a steam powered jack, versus in Europe, where maybe it was just simpler to keep the dogs running.
I feel like that's, like, one of those building codes where, like, you see it grandfathered in, right? Where you're like, oh, yeah, this is a new building. You can't have spit dogs in here. Or if it's, like, a really old building, they're like, we're going to do these renovations, but we're going to do it so we can keep our spit dogs. Because otherwise it's going to be a pain in my ass to install a steam-powered jack.
Exactly. And it wasn't until, like, the late 18th century that these and other solutions, including this jack that had, like, a wind-up clockwork mechanism, which seems really, like, wildly complicated for just, like, making sure your meat doesn't burn, those became accessible enough, you know, again, as we got closer to the turn of the 19th century, that people started to replace their dog treadmills. But yeah, just a little bit more about turnspit dogs, which I think are a beautiful and terrible human invention, like many dog breeds that exist today. They weren't just relegated to the kitchen. The lords and ladies of the house would actually use them as like living foot warmers at church on Sundays.
Oh my God.
And which is way cuter than the running on hamster wheels next to a hot fire thing.
Much like, cuter.
Yeah. Queen Victoria is said to have kept several of them as pets, which must have seemed really quirky. But even though she set lots of trends, that is not a trend that took off. They were generally considered ugly and mean, which I have to assume is because people kept making them run on hot treadmills that smelled like meat.
Yeah, you can't blame a dog with a line cook dog for being a little surly.
Exactly.
I'd be angry too.
Yeah. So once they became obsolete as kitchen utensils, they just quickly disappeared. And so they're considered extinct now, which is really funny because dog breeds aren't distinct species. So calling them extinct is kind of a misnomer. It's like how like cabbage, kale, broccoli, kohlrabi, Brussels sprouts, and a whole bunch of other plants are actually one species. So if we stopped eating cabbage and it disappeared, it wouldn't really be extinct. Like the makings of cabbage would still exist in the DNA of those other varietals. And so like similarly, any extinct dog breed is just one where we don't have proof that like a pure descendant of that exact lineage is still around. But generally speaking, like, there's always some idea of, like, what modern dogs they're really closely related to, and that sort of thing. I do have one picture of there's a taxidermied turnspit dog. This is the last known specimen.
God, I'm so afraid.
Wait, it's like dogs, one old... Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Sarah.
No, I was just going to say, I feel like the taxidermy dog is either going to be like, that looks just like a living dog, or like, dear God, that is terrifying.
Yeah. This looks like a wolf that someone pan-seared for half an hour.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah.
Okay. I am attempting to share screen, and here's the dog.
Oh, I think it's cute.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Wait, it's so much. What is the scale there? It looks so much more petite than I was picturing. Oh,
definitely very petite. Like the wheels were not large. Kind of like terrier sized, I would say.
Oh my God.
And a lot of the kind of like modern dogs it's thought to be related to are terriers. That picture, which I will post on popsci.com/weird, there's a great episode of Kitchen Sisters, an awesome podcast, talking about turnspit dogs from a few years ago. And the historian they talked to about that taxidermy was like, it's clearly lovingly done. Like, there are flowers in the, like, shadow box that it's in. The box is painted. But it was maybe their first attempt to taxidermy animal.
Ooh, okay.
Not very well done.
Lovingly done, but poorly executed.
Yeah.
Sure.
So it's hard to know exactly what they look like, except that that was, like, their size. They were a squat, sturdy but like petite dog. Also just like, you know, extinct dogs in general, or extinct breeds, again, like a dog breed being extinct is kind of like a weird concept. Yeah.
Right,
limited edition discontinued
a dead
dog.
Stock dog.
Yeah. But there were a couple that I found that I thought were really interesting because it really speaks to like how dog breeds you know, go away when there was some really specific purpose we were breeding into them that becomes obsolete. So one example is the Belgian Mastiff, which was this massive dog, like all Mastiffs are. But it was used to pull carts in Belgium and the Netherlands until the 20th century, like a little horsey. And then around World War II, I guess other countries started making fun of Belgium for having dogs pull around their groceries, and they stopped using them for that.
So this begs the question, like you said, a little horse, like, did they not know about horses in Belgium?
I really don't know.
It might have been
just the right size, maybe, to be
yeah.
like.
A horse is a little too big for your groceries, but a dog could be exactly right, you know?
All right.
It was like a milkman's cart would be pulled by this guy.
I'm just saying, like, I guess the way we treat animals, this is what it's reminding me, is the way we treat specific animals is kind of arbitrary, right? Like, which ones we assign labor to and which ones we treat as pets. So maybe in Belgium, they just, their little horses, like, lived in the house with them and would sometimes sleep in their beds if they were very permissive. And the dogs were the ones that they gave all the jobs to until someone was like, you got to switch this up. Your pet horse that you let sleep by the fireplace, this thing could be dragging your cart around town.
You got it all backwards.
Instead of this team of dachshunds you have on a rickshaw.
Well, and then one other defunct breed of dog I found that was really interesting. I didn't write the name down, but there are a lot of the quote-unquote extinct breeds are hunting dogs who were just bred to hunt really specific things. And like one of them, probably more than one of them, the reason it was so specific is that they wanted a dog that was really good at silently sniffing out a particular kind of prey, but not actually hunting it. Like those were the dogs that found it and they needed to do it really stealthily because then they would be like, all right, now other dog, go hunt that thing that hasn't yet realized there are dogs around. And like, wow. People are absurd. Just breed one dog to do that whole thing.
Yeah.
You know.
That was the snitch collie.
Exactly.
Just like, I'm not saying nothing, but if you're looking for if you're looking for a pheasant, all right. I've heard some things.
So, yeah, that is, you know, a brief overview of the turnspit dog, the dizzy dog. I would love to have one as a foot warmer. I think it sounds like they're probably really smart, industrious little dogs. And, you know, I'm really glad that, like, eating shawarma doesn't involve, like, a dog having
imagine if everywhere you went in New York, like every shawarma cart was just there was a little dog just like going in circles outside. Like tragic, yes. Would it make the streets of New York a little more adorable? Maybe.
Also, yes. Yeah, for sure. I feel like that is like not it would be like akin to the bodega cat, right? Like yeah. It feels like there are openings in New York institutions for other kinds of animals. A shawarma dog, a bodega cat, a deli bird. Like we get all sorts of, you know, like a hot dog cart parakeet.
Well, I also think like the only thing that it would take to make this a much more humane practice is to just have a ton of dogs.
Yeah, they like, just go as long as they want and then
yeah,
they
and then
out.
Another one pops in. Yeah, it could be a fun activity.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yep. I know dogs who would love to run in circles for an hour, just like burn off all that energy.
There's my dog, as I said before, just very old, very lazy. She would absolutely not be able to resist just trying to eat the meat that she was assigned to cooking.
Perhaps a good foot warmer though.
Great foot warmer. Absolutely. Yeah. She'd be great at half of this job.
Well, just a very specific, you know, it's like the hunting dogs that divide up the mm-hmm. labor. She's mm-hmm. right. She's just got the foot warmer part
She'd
covered.
She'd be the foot warmer. She wouldn't. I mean, I guess she could do it in church as as like a vocation, but she is a Jewish dog.
There's a little too much standing, I think, in synagogues to have a foot warmer be useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're up, you're down, you're startling your dog who just kind of got a good snore going. Oh, she snores really loud, so she would additionally be bad for a religious setting.
That might be your sinuses.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just she's got like, yeah. Oh, it's a problem.
Okay, we're gonna take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more facts. Okay, we're back. And Josh, why don't you talk to us about art heists?
Okay. So this is my favorite thing. I hope this isn't too redundant with information people already know, because there have been other podcasts and books about this, but this is like my favorite fact. And it's one that I kind of like retained as a kid and resurfaced in my brain as an adult, which is there's a museum. I'm from Massachusetts, and that we went when I was a kid on a field trip to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. And in the museum, a little history of the museum to start with. Isabella Stewart Gardner was born in New York in the 1840s. She moved to Boston with her husband. He died in 1898, and she started doing this thing they'd always planned, which was to start a museum. So you can see like what kind of financial bracket they were working in. If they were like, they weren't like, honey, should we have a garden? It was just like, hey, babe, you know what I was thinking? Let's do a museum. So he died, and she starts getting this museum ready. And so they had been all over the world and acquired art. When it's the 1800s, mid-1800s, and you're just, like, acquiring art from other countries, I don't really want to, like, vouch for that process as being ethical or fair. However, what the end result was that she built this this mansion built, basically, as a museum, and it's just full of all the art that she loved. And it's, like, the art itself, I have the webpage open because the art is like not consistent in any way. Like it's from all different countries. There are like paintings. There are like artifacts, and it's organized just by like how she liked it, like how much she liked different stuff. She was like, I think these look good together. And she was not, I believe, not like trained in curating art, but she did. She was very specific. So when she died, she was like, I'm going to leave. I want this to be a museum forever. I'm leaving this in a trust. But one of the conditions is that you can't move anything, which it's like visiting like a grandparent's house where everything, you know, it's like that's the room you don't sit in, even though there's a couch. Like everything just stays. And there's like a picture of your grandparents and they're very young nobody moves anything. Nobody touches anything. There's just like a glass jar full of seashells for some reason. So this is all fine and good. She was just like, keep it like it is. Then in 1990. So, oh, yes. Okay. So I'll just tell the story fairly linearly. In 1990, the night of St. Patrick's Day, I know. Okay.
St. Patrick's Day in Massachusetts, nothing good can happen.
St. Patrick's Day in Boston is chaos. Oh, no. It is. So the night of St. Patrick's Day, two robbers came in, I believe dressed as police, and they stole what the FBI has valued at over $500 million worth of art, including one of 34 known Vermeer paintings. The concert was one. The only seascape of Rembrandt's, which is called The Storm in the Sea of Galilee, sketches, a Chinese gu, I think I'm pronouncing that right, which is like a bronze vessel, excuse me. So just all the stuff stolen, never recovered. The case is open. The museum has a $10 million reward for information leading to the recovery of this art, which obviously hundreds of millions of dollars of artwork. I believe it stands as the largest unsolved art heist in history. But the fact that I love, that was so fascinating as a child and that it is so fascinating now, is that where the art was is empty. The robbers cut canvases out of their frames to just take them with them. Those frames remain empty on the wall of the museum. Yeah. So, like, you go into this museum and it looks like it's vaguely under construction because it's gone. And so there have been 30 years of investigations. And I really want to shout out the podcast Last Scene, which was a joint venture between WBUR, the Boston's public radio station, and the Boston Globe. And they go down all these kind of rabbit holes of like, maybe it was this segment of the Boston Mafia. Maybe it was Whitey Bulger. Maybe it was these other criminals from, you know, international art thieves that hit this museum knowing that on St. Patrick's Day, like, midnight to 2 a.m. on Sunday night after St. Patrick's Day was Saturday into, I mean, St. Patrick's Day is kind of a state of mind in Boston. Like, some people, I think, are constantly, it's constantly St. Patrick's Day, but they go hard. And so they seized upon this chaos. Oh, and it was also, there were thoughts about whether it was an inside job, whether one of the two night watchmen was involved. And all these leads have come up empty, as are the frames on the wall of this museum that you can go and see, which I think is like, that's pretty fun. Like, obviously you want to see Rembrandt's only seascape, but if you can't see Rembrandt's only seascape, don't throw up just another painting there and eliminate the history of this art heist. Leave it empty and just be like, no other paintings.
Because that was, how fun for the people who pulled this art heist that there
Very
is a,
fun.
A permanent tribute.
A lasting legacy.
Yeah.
Because now it's like it's both an art museum and also a museum about this one specific heist.
Yes, it's an art heist museum as well as an art museum.
I love that.
The Isabella Stewart Gardner / Ocean's 11 Museum in the Fens. And yeah, so I'm like obsessed with the heist in general, but also with the fact that they keep that because of this charter. And in the on the website to the museum, because I remember hearing on the tour when I was whatever 11 years old that it was the charter of the museum that said that they couldn't replace the art. And on the website, they kind of, there's a whole section devoted to the theft because it's such a big deal, and I imagine it like drives at least some of the visitors to the museum. But it says, let me find it, because they're a little gentler about the reason that they leave the frames open. I can't find it. When I was looking at it the other day, it said something like the single largest property theft in the world, they claim, on the website. It took 81 minutes. There's pictures on the website of one of the guards kind of duct taped to a pipe downstairs. And then empty frames. Today, empty frames remain hanging in the museum as a placeholder for the missing works and as symbols of hope awaiting their return, which I think is kind of a sweet way to say that. Right. Yeah, it's kind of like the...
Much sweeter than this dead lady made us promise we would never replace frames.
This dead old lady was like, don't move anything. I have it the way I like it. My ghost will know. And it is, like you brought up, Rachel, at the beginning of the podcast, Passover. And it's kind of like the idea of like the bitterness and the sweetness at once of like hope for the return, but also a reminder of like, whoopsie.
Yeah, I've been thinking since you mentioned that there would be an art heist involved in your fact, I was like, what does happen with stolen art, right? Because you can't just like go sell it to anybody.
Yeah.
People are looking for that stolen art.
You got to sell it to the right people.
You do have to sell it to the right people.
Yeah. And yeah, I read a few pieces about how, you know, unsurprisingly, there are rich people who are less scrupulous than others about, you know, some rich people love the brag of having some hidden stolen art in their home that only their, you know, close friends and associates can know about. But I also was reading that it's like stolen artworks that are recovered, it's often found that they were basically just used as like collateral in like, you know, in mobs and, you know, various criminal underbellies where it's just like, yeah, I got the goddamn Mona Lisa, so you can hold it while I go do this thing.
Yep.
And then I'll come back and take the Mona Lisa back. And like, what a bummer that so much stolen art is apparently just being used as like IOU markers.
So one thing that was interesting in the podcast last scene is that they really make the point that like, there's this image in the public imagination of like the art thief as like a gentleman criminal, right? Like an appreciator of art who's like, I shall have the Vermeer for my own. And then they're like sad to have to sell it to like a fence to, you know, to like, to get that money and have the art. They're like, it's beautiful, treat it well. But like in real life, it's just like whoever, it's the same kind of person that would do any kind of robbery. And I don't want to, like, by that I don't mean like anything derogatory other than it's not like an art appreciator. It is right. like the same it's, kind of person yeah. who would like rob a bank, but they're like, oh, I, instead of getting the money directly, we know how to get this art. Like, we know somebody on the inside, or we know a security vulnerability. And so it's like a very funny where it's just like, it's the same mob that steals other things. Like the same, yes, there's not like a secret like art mafia.
Right. And also then, like, you know, there's always the concern that the stuff is just going to be destroyed once it's more risky than it is
sure.
useful. So, yeah, like, if you're considering doing crime, just, like, consider doing it with something other than a priceless artwork.
Well, my favorite art crime is, I just watched that documentary, Made You Look, about the art forgeries. Yeah. And I think if you can forge a priceless work of art and sell it to a rich person, or, you know, through a gallery to a rich person, I think they shouldn't be able to prosecute you. I think you win fair and square.
Yeah, so that's... if you can trick someone into that, especially if you can trick someone who, like, verified the painting, like, yep. this is a legit, what I don't know enough about art to insert yep. an artist name here who you can forge effectively. I feel the same way, especially the rich person. Like, joke's on you,
absolutely.
Buddy.
Well, sorry. In that movie, there were people that were very mad that they felt defrauded out of $8 million that they spent on a Rothko. And on a Rothko that turned out to be forged. And nobody spends $8 million on a painting when they have a net worth of $8,050,000. Right. Like, they're not like, oh no, how do we pay our cell phone bills? We got screwed on this Rothko deal. So, like, I think if you can get, you know, if you're selling a painting for $1.2 million and it's, you trick the people that are supposed to verify, I think you don't get to bribe the people that verify it. This is my rule. But I think if you trick them, then it's no take backsies.
It's fair and square. There's a,
I think that's fair.
There's a museum of art fakes in Vienna that I have been to, and there's no like quote unquote real art in it. It is just about art forgery. It is incredible. I'm a big fan of, like, weird museums. If you're ever in Vienna, if ever we can go anywhere ever again, go to Vienna and go to the Museum of Art Fakes.
I want to do a fake version of that museum somewhere. I want to open up, like...
Would it be real art where it's fake fakes?
Oh, or... whoa. Yeah, that is awesome. Where you're just like, these are fakes. Wink. And you're like, these are incredible. And it's like, yeah, that's because Picasso did them. But I love art crimes.
Yeah, we had an episode of Weirdest Thing a couple years ago where I talked about this young female artist who claimed to have, like, uncovered the secrets of the Renaissance masters and mm-hmm. offered to teach these famous male painters how to effectively copy them.
Yeah.
And she ran a great scheme, because the thing is that when the men took her courses and still sucked at painting and weren't as good as painting as she was, her secret for copying the Renaissance masters was just that she was a better painter than the guys were.
Yeah, see, that's a great scam.
And no one wanted to admit it, so they would all just be like, yeah, I learned a lot, it was great, definitely pay her to do the same thing.
I'm like Monet now. Yeah, that's so funny, because that's like an unprovable scam, especially yeah. because she's so good at painting. It's yeah. like a, it's like a, the reverse of that popular, that axiom, right? This is those who can don't teach.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with one more fact.
Hey, weirdos, it's Corinne, the editor-in-chief here at Popular Science, jumping in to let you know about our brand new digital exclusive magazines. These quarterly issues feature our award-winning science journalism, the very best gadgets, and of course, journeys down science's weirdest rabbit holes. But being an official Popular Science subscriber gets you so much more than that. Our desktop and mobile apps have a catalog of more than 15 years of back issues. My favorite new feature? Siri or Google Assistant will read you the magazine. That means you can listen to PopSci like you would listen to a podcast. To get in on the action, go to popsci.com/subscribe. Our very first digital issue, which is all about the science and necessity of finding chill, is already there waiting for you to dig in.
Sarah, with some egg facts.
Some egg facts. So I do just have to start by saying I'm about to tell you basically like...
What I'm about to tell you will change your life.
It won't change your life. With regard to eggs. But I did feel a little like I was slandering chickens because I'm just going to talk to you guys about how all the ways it can go wrong. Like how many ways can you lay an egg badly? But I'd just like to set the record straight and say that chickens are really, really good at laying eggs. They lay, most of them lay like more than 300 eggs a year, which is like a crazy production rate. If you produced an egg every single day of your life, holy crap. And like the vast majority of them will be absolutely perfect and beautiful and wonderful, but some of them are not.
Don't let Big Chicken intimidate you, Sarah.
My printer just made a noise. I have a new printer and the printer just made a noise and I was like,
The chickens have hacked into the mainframe.
Yeah, it's gonna print out for me.
Yeah, it just is like a piece of paper comes out.
Okay, okay. So like, we're gonna start with least to most wrong. So the least wrong an egg can be is like it's just like missing a yolk, or it has too many yolks. So like double yolks eggs, those are pretty common. You can get more. The Guinness World Record is 5 yolks inside a 9-inch wide egg. I hope that's like long ways and not wide, because that's a rough time for the chicken.
That's a chicken
like ostrich
egg?
Size.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
I mean, it must be a bigger... It must be an ostrich egg or something. Like, it must be something big. Or like kiwis. Kiwis, by the time kiwis lay their eggs, they can't walk.
Right. Kiwis are all, they're like all egg.
It's all egg. So they're a weird bird.
Is the world record attributed to the bird or the person who like found it? Because I think the bird most of the credit.
Yeah, I mean, it's really to the egg, but I don't know if you know the name of the chicken or the ostrich or whatever it was. There's a record there's a rumor that the real record is like 9 yolks in an egg, but it's unconfirmed. The Guinness World Record people weren't there to see it.
They were like, that's just 9 eggs in one bowl. We can tell.
We cannot verify this. But yeah, I mean, that's basically for like the same way like humans have like twins or triplets or quadruplets or whatever, like that's basically the general idea. You can also get fairy eggs, which are also called fart eggs, dwarf eggs, wind eggs, or a lot of other names that I thought were too rude to mention here.
Wow.
But they're basically like little teeny tiny eggs, like the little eggs you get for Easter that are chocolate, but a real egg. Sometimes they're all whites, but sometimes they're just little tiny eggs. There's like weird shell abnormalities. You can get like really rough ones, like sandpapery. And that's if your chicken, I know, if the chicken deposits too much calcium in the shell, it gets real bumpy, which again, I mean, laying an egg can't be comfortable, and definitely laying a sandpapery one isn't.
Yeah.
Some eggs are wrinkly, which happens when there's like a problem partway through, like the eggshell breaks or something, but then sometimes the hen can like patch it back together basically, and so they end up wrinkly.
I've seen that before, like I'm sure, like not a profoundly wrinkly egg because it wouldn't have been sold to me if so, but I've definitely seen some eggs that I would describe as having wrinkly. A wrinkly quality to them.
Wow.
Yeah. And then
chicken.
Like...
Chicken buttholes are amazing.
They are.
Nature is incredible.
I once made a comment offhand about an egg coming out of a chicken butthole, and the people I was with made fun of me, being like, Rachel, they don't poop the eggs. And I was so effectively embarrassed me that I was like, oh gosh, you're right. And then later on, I was like, no, they do. There's one hole.
Yeah, it's a cloaca, right?
It's their
butt.
It's
a cloaca. Yeah, they do poop eggs.
Just because it's not strictly a butthole doesn't mean it's not their butthole.
Right.
It's a butthole plus.
Who's to say when it's being used as a butthole? And like maybe an egg comes out a butthole, or maybe it's an egg hole when an egg's coming out. This is a matter for philosophers. It's more of a philosophy question than a science question.
It truly Absolutely. Is. It's the next great chicken or the egg question. Mm-hmm. So then the color of the shell can vary a lot, and that depends on like the stage at which the color gets deposited. Like you can get blue eggs or green eggs. And if they're blue or green, that's like the whole shell all the way through is blue or green. If they're brown, you can actually wipe off the color when they're freshly laid, which is crazy. Like they've just been painted like little Easter eggs.
Wow.
That sounds really fake.
Yeah, it seemed not real. I Googled it a lot because I was like, there's no way that that's true. But it seems to be true.
Where I'm from, they sell, like, the eggs you generally get are brown eggs, and they, like, mm-hmm. in Massachusetts, and there's some, like, the egg council or whoever sold them had, there was, like, a slogan of encouraging you to get the brown eggs because they're locally produced.
Really? That's so interesting.
When I was a kid, I remember or it's just something my dad made up, which is so weird. I want to Google it, but I also, like, I can't face the fact that, like, did my dad just make up this slogan for eggs? But I think it's from, like, when he was a kid, and they would, like, push you to buy, like, locally produced brown eggs.
That's funny. People, I already said this egg fact, but in another podcast, alarmingly, but a lot of people think that brown eggs are, like, more organic or, like, more natural eggs, but they are not. The color of an egg is just dependent on what breed of chicken pooped it. And yes, they did poop it. There's also lash eggs, which are truly horrifying. I encourage you to never, ever Google it. They are, like, egg-shaped clumps of goop that happen when the, like, oviduct gets infected. So that's real nasty.
No, thank you.
But the actual fact I have to share with you today, I learned because our tech editor, Stan Horacek, tweeted about his wife asking him whether they had any lube on hand because she needed to stick her fingers up the chicken's butt/cloaca to see if an egg had gotten stuck. And that turned
Stan's
out
Stan's wife is a superhero.
She's incredible. Sarah Horacek. So I asked Stan a bunch of questions, and he was like, you know what? I don't know the answer to these questions, but Sarah would. So I'm just going to connect you guys. So about an hour after he connected us on email, I got this incredible response where she was just like, let me tell you about all the weird egg stuff that I know. So half of the facts you've already heard are from Sarah. So their chicken, Cleo, she thought was egg-bound, which is, like, exactly what it sounds like the egg gets stuck inside the hen. And there's some solutions to that, including, I found this advice on the internet, so I don't know how legit this is, but supposedly if your hen is egg-bound, you can just give her a nice little warm bath. You just want to relax her and soothe her, and then you put some KY jelly inside the cloaca to just kind of, like, lube it on up. And sometimes, I guess, that solves the problem. But Cleo, as it turns out, was not egg-bound, sadly. So she had something that's called egg yolk peritonitis. I couldn't figure out, like, why this happens. But as I said in my tease, like, basically, chickens can start laying little bits of egg, like one without a complete shell or, like, one that's ruptured. Like, often it's just, like, part of a yolk or something. And it just sort of goes into their body cavity. Like, it almost literally slips through some kind of gap between the ovaries and the oviduct, and it just sort of goes into the body. I'm not even really clear how. All the diagrams are just like, egg starts here, and then it just it just exits this little loop.
We don't actually know what's inside of a chicken. No one's ever looked.
It's just so. It's just a big old cavity. But then, like, because it's just like a loose yolk, that's bad for the chicken. So, like, a lot of times they get a really serious bacterial infection. And it's, like, it's hard to catch stuff like this early because I don't keep chickens. I hope to keep chickens someday because I think that their happy little clucking sounds are absolutely adorable. But because chickens are, like, prey species, they hide if they're feeling sick or, like, feeling crappy. So, like, mm-hmm. It's very hard to tell when your chicken is feeling sad or off. But also,
oh, they get shy.
I know, it's so sad. They, like, you know, they just want to be strong.
Right, they never let him see you cry. That's an old chicken mantra.
But weirdly sometimes, so the yolks can also, like, solidify into, like, a mass. Stan said that he thought it was from, like, their body heat. I don't know if that's true. I could not verify, like, why they solidify, but they act basically like a tumor, but made of solidified eggs. And that's what happened to Cleo the chicken. So
you're gonna find one of those inside me someday.
For Cleo.
I know. So yeah, if you catch it early, there is a treatment, which is that you give them hormonal injections or an implant. So there's a little thing called a Deslorelin implant. I'm sure I'm not saying that right, but it's like kind of like birth control, but for some animals. Yeah. So okay. It's like Implanon, but humans. Like, sorry, no. It's kind of like, it's not for humans. Don't give it to humans. It's kind of like Implanon is for humans, but it releases gonadotropin-releasing hormone, and you can use it to suppress fertility in, like, male dogs and ferrets and also male or female cats. And this is just a thing that you can get. I mean, like, I think most of the time you wouldn't get it from your vet, but, like, this is a thing. There's animal birth control, and I had no idea. That's not just, like, spaying or neutering them. Anyway, vets prescribe it off-label to chickens. It's not really supposed to be for them. But if you give them this little implant, it suppresses their egg laying. So you can, like, stop that process, and then you can, like, treat the infection if you get it really early. And at least one chicken blogger, there's a lot of chicken bloggers on the internet, at least one of them successfully treated her hen this way. But it seems pretty rare, and sadly, Stan told me that Cleo the chicken will not survive her egg yolk peritonitis.
Oh, no.
I know. So, surprise, this was a sad... I know, I'm so sorry. It turned out to be sad in the end. This
you
episode
got me
is,
again.
I'm so sorry. I just want to dedicate the episode to Cleo the chicken, because without her, we would not have these facts.
Can we get
I'm so sorry.
R.I.P.
Play as much Sarah McLachlan as we could afford to play here, Jess. Mm-hmm.
29 Maybe. Seconds worth.
Yeah.
In the wings of wings.
Oh god, I'm gonna start crying just from that. So those are my egg facts. I don't think I have another episode's worth of egg facts, so this is probably
gonna
maybe not about chickens.
Yeah, other eggs.
It's time
I'm
to
sure.
branch out on the eggs.
Yeah.
Or other non-egg chicken facts.
Yep.
So
yeah. Oh god, all right. Well, I'm gonna find one. Now you've challenged me and I have to have another egg fact or chicken fact episode.
Yeah, there are so many other animals that lay eggs. I
yeah,
feel like
yeah, true.
You're just scratching the surface. I was picturing, when you said the egg inside the chicken cell, until I realized that it was just the yolk, more or less, right, loose in their chicken tubes. I was like, could an egg just hang out inside a chicken until they give birth? Like a live birth?
Oh, God, like it just keeps going.
Yeah, that's what I was worried about. But it sounds like no, right? It sounds like it's not a fully formed egg with a shell. Yeah,
it's not. But that is why kiwis have such big eggs, because like most animals that lay eggs do it so you can just like cook them partway and then put them outside your body. But kiwis, like, they still lay the egg, but the little baby kiwi develops like almost entirely while it's still inside its mom. So that's why they have such big eggs.
So like a kiwi could maybe just not, they could just do away with the egg part.
They probably could, yeah, and they just haven't. Evolution was like, you're stuck with this forever.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, kiwis are crazy. The people and the birds, to be honest.
All right, well, what was the weirdest thing we learned this week?
God, I don't know. There were a lot of weird things in this one. A
lot of weird
yeah,
things.
Yeah, it's true. We had a lot of like tangential weird things.
Yep.
I think this may be a three-way tie this week. I think all three of our facts taught me new things.
Me too. Yeah.
Is this a first time three-way tie?
Oh no, I've definitely pulled this crap
so
before.
We're just indecisive
sometimes. Yeah.
I love it. I don't think there's a reason we don't need to make facts compete.
No, they're all equally good facts.
Yeah. Sometimes facts, yeah. Sometimes it's just the love of the game.
Exactly.
The game called science.
That's what we do. Josh, thank you so much for joining us.
What a treat. Thank you for having me.
And listeners who don't already, definitely check out Make My Day, where facts do not have to compete.
No. Everything is fully invented. It is... It's chaos. It is a game show where there's only one contestant, so they always win. And the each week, the winning contestant and only contestant wins a $100 donation to the charity or cause of their choice. And it's really fun. It's the only game show that I know of where no one ever loses. And so it's very stress-free. That's what I strive for.
That's what we need right now, honestly. Just a zero stress game show.
Thank you.
The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week is a Popular Science podcast. We're available on all major podcast platforms, so subscribe wherever you're listening now. And if you like what you hear, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps other weirdos find the show. For more information on the stories you heard in this episode, come find us at popsci.com/weird. You can buy our merch, including Weirdest Thing t-shirts, tote bags, and mugs, at popsci.threadless.com. The show is produced by all of our hosts, including me, Rachel Feltman, with editing and audio engineering by Jess Bodie. Our theme music is by Billy Cadden. If you have questions, suggestions, or weird stories to share, tweet us at weirdest_thing. Thanks for listening, weirdos.